KCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. It's been a tough day in Newark, New Jersey, where one police officer is dead and another is in critical condition after a shooting. The state attorney general calls it a painful reminder of the sacrifices police officers make. A 14-year-old is charged with murder. In Essex County, prosecutor Theodore Stevens says
one gun was recovered from the suspects. Several individuals are in custody as a result of that interaction, and they're being interviewed by the police and by the Essex County Prosecutor's Office.
The back and forth on those tariffs imposed, then paused by President Trump, is causing worries for some businesses in the U.S. CBS's Lauren Toms in San Francisco says some farmers are being forced to increase their prices.
At Castellano's farm, it's planting season, but Joel says tariffs and supply chain disruptions have already driven materials costs up by at least 30% for essentials like drip tape and metal stakes that are often imported from China, Canada, and Mexico, which have been targets of a trade war.
We're not complaining. We're just talking about it. We have to buy it. There's no other way around it.
Some need snow boots and others need umbrellas on this busy weather weekend. CBS News meteorologist John Elliott.
It's going to be a busy day for parts of Louisiana and Texas. And then again, you've got it both ways. You've got storms and you've got a blizzard. During your Saturday, these storms continue to march into parts of Georgia and more of Florida Sunday into Monday.
Impeached South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is out of prison a day after a court canceled his arrest to allow him to stand trial without being physically detained. If a court upholds his impeachment, a national election will be held to find his successor within 2 months. The BBC's Jean McKenzie.
In the early evening, Mr. Yoon walked out of the detention center where he's been held for 52 days since he was arrested and charged for trying to bring South Korea under military control. He greeted his cheering supporters before being driven home.
Experts say Gene Hackman died of heart disease and was suffering from advanced Alzheimer's as well. His wife died of a rare rodent-based virus. Forensic pathologist Dr. Victor Whedon.
The person who is dependent on the caretaker who died, they can't always communicate that to other people. They may or may not be able to care for themselves.
The 95-year-old Oscar winner and his 65-year-old wife, Betty Arakawa, were found dead in their New Mexico home on February 26. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Brittany Merlot with WXCO News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section on the WXCO website at BullFallsRadio.com.
Smith Show, thanks so much for being here. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Oh boy, the responses to yesterday's show were plentiful, and I guess the Red Hats are really paying attention to the show. Thank you for tuning in. I actually got a couple of people saying, you know, I didn't think of something that way. You made me think. That massive compliment. Absolutely the best compliment I could get from anyone is when they go, you know, I hadn't thought of something that way. Made me think. We need to do more of that. Because what was interesting is there was a theme, and I'm not quite sure where this group of folks are coming from, but they all seem to kind of have the same undercurrent of Trump is changing America. And it feels coordinated. And that's, I guess, a good thing that someone is talking to their friends. And understand, there is a massive shift going on in this country. And I don't think it's for the better. You know, I had a number of these folks say, you know, there was the shift of the Reagan era. And I don't think that was a great, for working people, that was not a great time. And now you're seeing another shift. And this push towards more hyper-conservatism is interesting to me, because if you go back to the Reagan-era conservatives, because the goalposts seem to keep moving to the extreme. Whereas Reagan was right, center-right, little bit further than center right. These folks are flat out fascistic. I mean, if you go back and you look at the Reagan era conservative values, those values that were prevalent, you know, smaller government, free markets, strong defense, you know, that whole family values thing. But individualism, hyper-individualism, and personal responsibility, that was who they were. It was big with them. It's kind of what they believed in, especially traditional kind of family values where if you would have gone back to that era and you would have told those people that they would be, you know, eventually morphing into supporting someone who is a philanderer, who is, you know, filed bankruptcy multiple times and lies, you know, almost every word. This idea of traditional conservatism, we're in a weird spot because you've got Trump, who's got this kind of populist, don't care about, you know, free markets or fiscal conservatism or limited, you know, it doesn't seem to care about what conservatives have generally touted, but the conservatives have jumped in his bandwagon. And the kind of nationalism that we got during the Reagan years was, you know, strong national defense, but, you know, American exceptionalism. You know, we're exceptional. And we're the beacon of hope for the world. We're that shining city on the hill of which we are the global player. Whereas what we're getting from Trump is an isolationist position and basically wanting to pull us out of foreign entanglement, any international entanglements, any agreements. All that stuff seems to be up in the air. You know, as where Reagan was peace through strength, what it seems like is, well, Trump is, peace through surrender. And I don't say that lightly. Because if you look at what they're doing to Ukraine, it's quite remarkable. No Reagan-era conservative ever would have taken that position. So it's, for me, as someone who has watched the Republican Party, you know, morph from that Reagan-era kind of thought to where we are now, it's really bad. And, you know, the immigration thing, you know, Reagan, you know, pushed for and signed the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 86, which gave amnesty to millions of people, created pathways to citizenship, did a whole bunch of things to try and solve the problem. We've got none of that out of Trump. There's no policy. There's no plan. There's just brutality. And this is where, if you're consuming some of foreign media, this is one of those things. Yeah, there's always the ugly American, the loudmouth American, the chest thumping American. Now it's more the brutal American, the cruel American. Something that I never thought we would be associated with. And this is the place where I'm kind of concerned about where we're going. The fact that you've got the Trump people talking about realigning our allegiance to NATO. They're talking, they call it a policy shift. And what it is, it's a shakedown. It's what mobsters do. And am I surprised that this is how Trump reacts? No, this is what the Trump mobster presidency does. And they're saying that, you know, We may not come to the aid of all NATO members, just the ones that we think are contributing. And I thought the whole point of NATO was like a national alliance to provide security for each other, mutual aid kind of thing, to be a visual deterrent so that nobody would screw with anybody else, and thus you're causing peace. Now, again, this is what my conservative friends, this is what all of these folks are saying. They want peace. And, well, I do too. The difference is I don't want surrender. And this is the part that where I come back to that's a struggle for me. Because, look, I was against going into Afghanistan. I was against going into Iraq. much more against going into Iraq. I was in favor of going after bin Laden, but not a full-scale war like Russia did in Afghanistan. And again, if we learn our history, you know, we funded massively the Taliban and the folks in Afghanistan to fight the Russians off, which they did. They were never going to win that war, but they didn't lose. And I kind of see what's going on in Ukraine is the same thing. If we're going to give up and surrender and hand Ukraine over to Russia, what does that mean for the next country? What does that mean as Putin expands more? And I know, we don't know he's going to do that. Yeah, we don't know he's not. All indications, in my view, is that he wants to get the band back together. He's been very clear about Russia's future. So as I look at this and I look at the fact that Trump's talking about revoking the legal status of about 250,000 Ukrainians, it seems tit for tat. It seems like that kind of bullying tactic that you would expect from a brutal, cruel dictator. But understand this shift in NATO, this shift in our positions around the world. If you want to talk about what's going to lead to World War III, it's Donald Trump. So when I had people emailing me saying, well, if you're back in Ukraine, you're back in World War III, and you go, no, that's not how this works. If you're backing Russia, which it's interesting to me that we're demanding Ukraine give up all kinds of concessions. I haven't heard anything about what the Russians are going to do. That's going to lead us to World War III. And this idea, and I've heard this a bunch of times, Joe Biden looked weak. This kind of surrender, this kind of you don't have cards, this kind of bullying of Zelensky in the White House. Sorry, the Red Hats may be thrilled that he looked tough, but the entire rest of the globe saw it for what it was. I had someone write me, he said, America was our friend, the kind of friend you don't want to have. And that, to me, is a struggle. I love this country. I think we've done as a country more than any country in the history of humanity. We're in a weird spot. Now, I do find it interesting that the woman who said, this caught my attention, the woman who said there's nobody who will fight harder for America than Donald Trump, except, I guess, the bone spurs, which got him out of being drafted. Or going to the military. She said this week, and again, this is the kind of shift that I'm talking about. Republicans have always been the party of the military. They've always been the party of photo ops and draping themselves in the flag, especially if there's the blood of a soldier on it. She, in talking about the layoffs, the firings that are happening in the federal government by Doge and the ferrets, it's one of those things where I'm not gonna give her the out of saying she just misspoke, because I believe this is what they believe. She was asked about the firings and she said, I really don't feel sorry for them. They should get back to work for the American people like President Trump and this administration. That's something the president has always cared about. Anybody in blue, anybody that served this country. But at this time, we have taxpayer dollars. We have a fiscal responsibility to use the taxpayer, the people's money, that actually work. That doesn't mean we forget our veterans by any means. We are going to care for them in the right way, she says. But perhaps they are not fit to have a job at this moment. Or they're not willing to come to work. And it was that thought process of, well, they're not fit to come to work. What does that mean? Don't know. But it's laying the justification for kicking veterans to the curb. And I'm someone who's always said we use our military sparingly, because if we do send people into harm's way, we have to take care of them, regardless of what it costs. there are people right now talking about, you know, if you were one of those people who answered the call and went off and fought, and you're injured and your body's broken and your mind is broken and you're collecting a pension and disability, they want to take one of those away. Is this what we voted for? We're taking food out of the mouths of children. We're risking Medicaid for seniors, and we're screwing over veterans? Makes me wonder. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Here's a quick break. When we come back, Katie Harris from the Blue Green Alliance is going to be here to share some thoughts on Republicans maybe finding labor. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as we talked about yesterday on the program, workers are looking for a way to make their lives better, and unions do that. We talked about union neutrality agreements being very popular. In fact, the most recent poll, 63% of people polled said, yeah, we should be able to join and form unions without harassment and intimidation. Seems like that should be a little bit higher. Also, 73% said project labor agreements, something we should have. Setting a floor on standards in building constructions seems sane, seems rational, seems like something we should all consider. It's, again, seems like, in my view, should be a little bit higher, but we are where we are and in a good place. Now, as I said, this week, you saw two major pieces of legislation being floated, one by a Republican, Josh Hawley, called the Faster Labor Contracts Act, and another by Bernie Sanders, Bobby Scott, Democrat from Virginia, and Brian Fitzpatrick, I believe the only Republican from here in my state of Pennsylvania, who have brought forth the PRO Act again, the Richard L. Trumka Protecting the Right to Organize Act, and here to share some thoughts on, well, was it a good week for labor? I've asked Katie Harris to come talk with us. Katie's the Vice President of Federal Affairs at the Blue Green Alliance. Katie, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So all in all, you could say this is a good week for labor. You got two pieces of legislation focused on labor rights, one from a Republican, Josh Hawley, and one from, well, a very bipartisan group of Sanders, Fitzpatrick, and Bobby Scott. Thoughts on this is good, bad, where are we?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Hawley legislation is pretty weak, frankly. And I really think that the PRO Act, Protecting the Right to Organize Act, is much stronger and has a lot of good stuff in it that would, you know, close some loopholes and allow workers to really exercise the right to organize, hold employers accountable, and just overall go a long way to securing free and fair union elections.
And how does it do that?
It does that in a whole bunch of ways. I'll try not to get too wonky on you, but a couple of things. So one, you know, we've got the National Labor Relations Board. Right now, workers who suffer some kind of retaliation, so let's say they get fired because they're trying to organize on the job, they're often forced to wait months, sometimes even years, before their case goes in front of the NLRB and it gets resolved. One way the PRO Act would change that is it would require the NLRB to immediately seek an injunction to just reinstate the employees. So it doesn't necessarily solve, you know, the organizing problem, but it means that you you have your job while you're trying to organize. Another really great thing that it does is it prevents captive audience meetings. So your employer could no longer bring you in and sit you down and hand you pizza and tell you why you don't need a union. So just a couple of examples there of what the PRO Act would do.
So, you know, in looking at this, you know, one of the things that I always say about the National Labor Relations Act is what it did is it gave workers a little bit of rights, understanding that they had none before, that the employer controls, you know, what hours, what conditions, what wages, all of those things, and that the NLRA gave some rights to workers to kind of attempt to balance the playing field and to negotiate on a fairer field. It sounds to me like we're returning to that idea of just by what you laid out. Especially if, you know, because one of the things employers do in every organizing campaign is they fire somebody, and there's a chilling effect that runs across the entire campaign, which generally goes, sadly in the wrong direction most times. But by doing what you said and putting the person back to work and then hashing it out, that kind of swings that pendulum back into leveling the playing field. Or am I reading that wrong?
No, you're definitely reading that right. That's the whole point of PRO Act, is to try to swing the pendulum back and really give labor law more teeth, you know, more enforceability.
Because if you look at where we are, and look, the anger out there in the American workforce is real. The struggle is real. The suffering is real. The standard of living decline over the last 40, 50 years has been real. We're at kind of one of those moments where there has to be some action to turn that around, or I think that anger just continues to grow and grow until, well, maybe we're right back to where my grandparents' generation was, where they were literally tearing this country apart brick by brick.
Right. I mean, there's the, I think, fairly famous stat at this point that over the last 50 years or so, wages for the bottom, I think it's 10% of households, no, 90% of households, sorry, getting it flipped around. 90% of households increased just 44%. So it did increase, but not that much. But then if you look at the wealthiest 1%, so the, you know, oligarchs, tech guys that we see in the news these days, they had an increase of 180%. It's a huge difference. So that pain is very real. and the PRO Act, if it were to pass, would help with that.
Yeah, I mean, this is just one of those moments where you have to, the numbers are what they are. And what built the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity were strong labor unions, was government action that encouraged collective bargaining. Now, they didn't put their thumb on the scale of what those contracts were going to look like or not look like. They just said, go to the table, work something out. And if it ends in a strike, well, you have the right to strike. To me, that's the perfect scenario. That's not putting your thumb on the scale. That's just simply saying you both are going to have to figure this out. And oh, by the way, employers, you don't get to go in and wipe out all the workers and replace them with somebody else. You actually have to negotiate. I think that's where we should be heading for.
Right. I mean, it's about exercising your basic rights and your rights to a free and fair union election, too. That's exactly right.
But is that a basic right? I mean, you know, my grandparents' generation believed that was their right, and they fought for it. They bled for it. They died for that, literally. And I think we've gotten our generation, this generation in the last, a little soft on that militancy of, you know, we demand better wages. We demand to be paid what we're worth, what we create, the wealth that we create for people. We should have a part of that.
Right. I mean, there's no employer in the history of the world has ever said, "Oh, I'm gonna give you this to be nice." The workers have to ask for it, have to negotiate for it. Through collective bargaining is one of the strongest ways.
Now, Republicans control the House and the Senate. Obviously, you know that. The PRO Act, the Richard L. Trumka Protecting the Right to Organize Act, is one of the Democratic Party's main bills. It's labor's number one priority. It's something that the potential Secretary of Labor, Lori Chavez de Remer, once supported, now not so much. Does this have a chance in a Republican House, Republican Senate with a Republican president?
You know, I don't think it does. It's passed the House twice when Democrats were in control. It's never passed the Senate since it was first introduced in 2019. But the important thing is that this keeps getting reintroduced and people keep seeing it. And you know, Democrats and our friend Representative Fitzpatrick keeps fighting for it, keeps some momentum going so that, you know, someday, knock on wood, this thing can actually pass. But I don't think it's this Congress.
Right. No, but the reason I bring that up is because, look, Josh Hawley, who I do not think is a friend of labor. I know my union, the Teamsters, their president, Sean O'Brien, thinks that he's changed Hawley's heart. And that, you know, he's, you know, there are Republicans who are going to be pro-labor. He has introduced this Faster Labor Contracts Act, which, again, in my view, is a third of what the Employee Free Choice Act once was. So we've even watered that down. Is it possible that this passes and what you have is Republican messaging saying, look, here's a piece of legislation that we gave to you labor people. This is what you wanted. Do you see this as something that could pass?
I think it's pretty unlikely too. You know, Josh Hawley is one thing, but the entire Republican caucus is another, and I think that they're not willing to even probably go that far.
No, because this is one of the key parts of what the Employee Free Choice Act is. For those who don't remember, EFCA had three parts. One was neutrality, was card check. If you had enough cards, the employer would recognize the union or trigger a vote, and there was a whole process for that. There was the part of increasing the fines on employers being guilty of unfair labor practices, and then there was this part, the part of first contract arbitration, ensuring that a first contract was gotten. So it seems like we've watered that down. Do you see how this could be beneficial, though?
Well, if you operate by the, you know, baby steps are better than nothing, sure. But I think there's always the worry, right, of is that all you're going to get? Which would take me right back to the PRO Act, which has everything that needs to happen.
Right.
Instead of Hawley's bill.
Because the one response that I've gotten from people is that, well, I want the perfect over the practical. I want the bill that I want, and I'm not going to move off of something that could incrementally move us forward. My problem is I don't see that this Fast Contract Act really moves us that much forward, especially in the Trump era, because the person who's going to issue that binding contract might not be a friend or even neutral.
Right. And then you have to have a functioning NLRB.
Well, there is that.
So, yeah. Yeah. No, I share that concern for sure.
Because, you know, I know there's a lot of want to do something. And I know Republicans in this moment see labor and your statistic, you know, your survey, an important part of this. The fact that, you know, the broad base of people in this country want stronger unions. They want union neutrality. They want project labor agreements. They want those things. And I think Republicans are trying to find a way to say that they're in favor of it without actually moving and doing something that would be beneficial. Does that make sense?
I think that's exactly right. They're using it as a, you might call it like a messaging tool, but they're not, I don't think they're serious about finding a way forward, a way to help unions.
Yeah, I know they're words, lots of words, mm-hmm. not much on the action front. So, you know, in this, as you've said, you know, in these were your words, you don't think it's going to happen on the PRO Act. This to me seems to be one of those, you know, which side are you on kind of moments where, you know, Republicans have put forth their kind of bill, and Cory Booker, I guess, is on board with Hawley's bill. And then there's the bill that labor wants. Thoughts on what you do with this messaging wise? Because for me, it seems glaring that, you know, now we get to find out which side people are on by the votes that they may or may not cast. Any thoughts?
I mean, for us, and I think for our labor partners too, we're all in on the PRO Act. You know, don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good, but this bill has been around for many years now, and it's shown that it has the votes in the right circumstances, right? It's passed out of the House a couple of times. So for us, it's keeping the flame alive. Yeah. Until the time we have the political will.
Yeah, see, but I remember when EFCA was the bill that labor wanted. The Employee Free Choice Act. And I remember I shook Barack Obama's hand twice when he was a candidate, and he told me we were getting something better. and we ended up here. We are all these years later. We've got nothing. So the folks who are yelling at me, going, "Take what you can get," on this Holly bill, I'm not sure where we go from there.
Yeah, look, I think the proof is in the pudding. I'll be very curious to see if Holly's bill actually moves forward, or if it just becomes, you know, a chance for him to say some nice things.
Yeah, no, and look, at the end of the day, what we want workers to be able to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, especially with all the talk of reshoring manufacturing and building a new economy. That new economy should come with family-sustaining wages. But, Katie, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with us. Keep up the great work over there at the Blue-Green Alliance, and I look forward to talking to you again.
All right. Thanks so much.
Katie Harris, Vice President of Federal Affairs there at the Blue-Green Alliance. Check out their website, bluegreenalliance.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, Wausau's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Central Wisconsin weather, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, a slight chance of snow, then partly sunny and breezy. Highs in the low 40s, clear tonight, 23. Sunshine and breezy for Sunday with a high near 51. Gorgeous Monday, sunshine with highs in the upper 50s. 46 Tuesday.
Right now, it's 37.
Judge Brad Schimmel is an anti-choice politician whose positions are too extreme for Wisconsin women. He supports a pre-Civil War law that bans abortion. But don't take our word for it. Hear it in his own words.
The 1849 ban on abortions. Which, by the way, what is squad about that?
The 1849 abortion ban provides no exceptions for rape or incest.
What is squad about that?
The 1849 law criminalizes doctors.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday, according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, yesterday, March 6th, that's the day they call Millionaire's Day. That's the Social Security Millionaire's Day milestone. That's the day that they have said that the millionaire class, you know, our rich folks, that's the day that they all stop contributing to Social Security. And again, March 6th is the day that they stopped for this year. And that cap number right now is, what, I think $176,100. That's where they stopped taxing. Everything over, that dollar over $176,100, that doesn't get taxed by Social Security. And then all the way to a gazillion, where you get Elon Musk, who paid all of his Social Security taxes in, what, the first 8 or 10 seconds of the year. So what you have is you have this massive hole while we're trying to destroy Social Security. Yay. But that doesn't stop there. Yeah, I know taxes are really exciting and sexy, but corporate America is fighting to get one back that they thought they had. And if you go back to the Trump years, corporate America thought they had it in place, thought it was going to make them fat and happy. But you know, Biden came in and destroyed it all. Well, they're back to fighting for their tax break, and here to share some thoughts on what that is and how it will work. I'd ask my good friend Will Rice to come share some thoughts. He's with the group Americans for Tax Fairness, AmericansForTaxFairness.org, if you want to take a look at their work. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me back, Rick.
So here we are, corporate America fighting to fatten the coffers a little bit more at the expense of average, everyday working people, because while we're giving them tax breaks and all that, prices keep going through the roof. But walk me through this most recent want and hope and dream and the new analysis that you guys have got out.
Okay, well, it all starts back in 2017, the last time Donald Trump was president and he had a Republican Congress. And many people may remember they enacted a big tax bill. And the centerpiece of that tax bill was a huge cut in the corporate tax rate.
Right.
Two-fifths percentage cut. And many of us were opposed to that, because if you can remember back to 2017, it's not like American corporations were starving. They were doing just fine. They had plenty of profits. But this this law cut their the official tax rate that they had to pay down by two-fifths. And Congress has certain, you know, complicated budget rules. And one of them says, if you're going to cut someone's taxes or cut people's taxes and create more deficits thereby, there's got to be a limit to that. So the Republican tax writers thought, well, let's make it look like we're going to raise taxes just a little bit on some of these corporations, and that will offset some of the cost of this big rate cut. So in three different areas, they said, in 5 or 6 years from now, we are going to tighten up the rules on how you can deduct certain things, and that will, in essence, bring in more tax money for us. Now, the understanding all across Capitol Hill was these tighter rules were never going to come into effect. They would just pass the tax bill back in 2017, and then sometime before these new tighter rules were supposed to come into effect, they would go in and abolish them. Well, someone wasn't paying enough attention, because these tighter rules actually did come into effect in 2022 and 2023. So corporations were in an uproar about this, and they are demanding that these tighter rules be taken away. They get to go back to the looser rules where they save a lot of money on their taxes, and they're making that part of this larger tax battle that's going on right now in Washington. And so the report that we just issued, along with the organization Lower Drug Prices Now, is about just one of those, how corporations are allowed to deduct the cost of research, and specifically how big drug companies are allowed to do that.
You know, it's amazing how they write these rules. And this is what I think, why average Americans are frustrated by what they see in Washington, because, you know, they do this, they push, this will be down the road, and we'll get tougher later. And they know that's never going to happen, because nobody is ever going to run on, especially from the Republican side, on raising taxes. So it's infuriating to find out that this is how they play this game out, and how corporate America always seems to be the benefactor of these schemes, while we end up paying more and more, not just in taxes, but in costs as well. Because, as you pointed out, they're doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They absolutely are. And of course, a lot of promises were made about this tax law back in 2017 that would raise workers' salaries, would raise incomes for working class people, that it would lead to an investment boom that would lead to more jobs. And none of that, by the time a pandemic hit in 2020, none of that had happened. Of course, the pandemic, you know, scrambled the economy, so we can't really tell what the effect is after that. But in the few years before that, what basically happened was corporations took these huge tax cuts and just gave them to their shareholders and their CEOs through huge buybacks and dividend payments and higher salaries. So the money went to the top and just stayed there.
Yeah. When are we ever going to learn? Because I didn't even need you to answer that like that, to know that we gave them massive tax cuts. They told us they're going to reinvest in business and reinvest in education and reinvest in, you know, all these other ways. When all we find out is what they do with the tax breaks is line their pockets with it. I mean, we learn?
I don't know. They've been trying to sell us this trickle down snake oil for over 40 years now. And I think actually people have learned. The problem is the politicians haven't caught up to where the people are. I think that the polling shows that everyone thinks that rich people and corporations should be paying higher taxes, fairer taxes, and even majorities of Republicans.
Yeah.
So it's really a matter of the power of these large corporations and of billionaires like Elon Musk are preventing Congress from doing what the people actually want, which is raising taxes on large corporations and billionaires and using that money to fund services that help working families.
Now, this argument that you know, they need these breaks so that they can invest in their business, maintain R&D, research and development. Now, you've said this doesn't hold water, but given that, you know, there's probably a new argument here for me, given the fact that the Trump administration is gutting all of this stuff. And there's, you know, maybe there's no more money for research and development, and this is going to fall onto the private sector, which gives me no warm fuzzy feeling inside. Is there a legitimate argument for that?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think that corporations have a way of getting what they need from the government, and they'll go on doing that. What we found was these eight large drug companies, along with the rest of corporate America, claimed, well, if we can't deduct research expenses the way we used to, in the more lucrative way we used to, we just won't do research anymore, and we won't be coming up with miracle drugs. Well, as it turns out, basically, there was no change in how much money they spent on research from when they could deduct more of it, from when they can deduct less of it. So like a lot of these corporate tax handouts, it doesn't really incentivize corporations to do something they wouldn't already do. It just gives them money for things they already would do.
Right.
So it's just an extra bonus for them.
No, and this is where having that conversation of you know, if you're running a business, does a tax incentive really incentivize you to do what you would have done anyway, what your core business is, which is developing new drugs, which is, you know, getting people to buy the ones you've got. It seems odd to me, but let's say that tax break had gone into place. How much are we talking about corporate America line? How much are we talking about these drug companies putting in their pockets?
Well, just in 1 year, in 2023, based on how much they spent on research, if these more favorable rules had been in effect then, they would have collectively saved over $15 billion. Or they could have saved up to that much or even more. It depends on how much they paid, what their tax rate was. But based on the statutory tax rate of 21%, they would have saved over $15 billion among them. And again, those savings would not have gone into lowering drug prices for consumers and patients or for the government that pays for a lot of these things. They would have, based on history and everything we've ever seen, would have just gone to more share buybacks and corporate executive pay increases.
It's really remarkable when you eight companies, $15 billion. I mean, just that's, you know, I Warren Buffett popped into my head, and you know, Warren Buffett said that if every one of the eight top 800 companies in the country were to pay the same kind of taxes that Berkshire Hathaway pays, that his company pays, nobody would have to pay any into any tax system, because they pay above, I guess, they don't I guess you would probably know better than I do, they don't go after and hire armies of lawyers to look for every loophole. They pay their tax rate. If we had a corporate structure that did that, could we have that world?
Well, I mean, yes. The point is that the very, very rich make money in a way that doesn't allow us to properly tax them. And corporations can use offshoring and a lot of other accounting maneuvers to avoid taxes. And that's why we have the infuriating phenomenon of tax-free corporations in many years and tax-free billionaires in certain years. So that's the whole reason that our organization started, is because we need to reform the tax code if we're going to build an economy that works for everyone, not just those at the top.
Yeah, because this is one of those things that, and it's really hard to talk about tax structures and policy, because it's complicated. There's a lot to it. But to simplify it, you know, I go back to my grandparents' era. You know, when we had the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity, we didn't have an Elon Musk. We didn't have the robber barons of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, like we did of the 1880s and 90s, and like we have today, because we had a much different tax structure, one that was very progressive, one that said that, you know, the bigger your shoulders, the more water you got to carry. We're not that country anymore.
No, we're not. And we've been going in the wrong direction again since the 1980s, basically. Just another thing I wanted to point out about these drug companies is that the American people basically pay multiple times for the success of these drug companies. One thing that's important to know is that the federal government, National Institutes of Health, basically pays about half the cost of most of the basic research that goes into the drugs that these companies make. So they're each putting up about the same amount of money. The difference is, if they hit a winner and it becomes a bestseller, the corporation makes a whole bunch of money and the federal government doesn't get anything. So the taxpayers are helping to develop these drugs. Then the drug corporations are dodging their taxes on the profits they make from it. And then when you go up to the pharmacy counter or the federal government, you know, pays through Medicare or Medicaid, they're gouging them. So the drug companies are taking our money in three different ways. And I think people, if they don't know all the details, they get that sense. And it's true. And this report is just one more way of saying corporations continue to scrounge for more and more tax breaks. They don't need them. They're doing very well without them. And politicians should stand up for them and say, no, that's enough. You don't need any more tax breaks.
No, no. And we need a tax code. And we need a society again. I mean, I go back and I think of, you know, especially on the drug front, you know, Jonas Salk, you know, came up with the polio vaccine, didn't profit off of it. The guy mm-hmm. who I was just reading something the other day, and I forget the guy's name off the top of my head, the guy who developed insulin, mm-hmm. you know, for use, you know, sold the patent for like a dollar. I mean, we're definitely not that country anymore.
No, no. Drug companies are some of the most profitable in the world. And they're they're saving from the tax, the part of the tax law from 2017 that actually cut taxes, they're saving tens of billions of dollars, the healthcare field in general, and including the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I don't see them ever lose.
So this one adverse part of that law, this one part of the law that actually made them pay a little more in taxes, that's why they're so outraged about it, because every tax law is supposed to lower their taxes. None of it's supposed to raise them. And so they are working furiously to get this thing reversed.
And do you expect this to be part of Trump's tax bill? Because again, I think during Trump's first term, his tax bill was the only legislative policy agenda they got it through. Do you expect mm-hmm. something like that to happen again?
Oh, yeah. I mean, corporations are definitely going to fold this into, because what's happening on a broader basis is, again, because of these budget rules, they used a gimmick that said, we're passing this law, but most of it's going to expire in 10 years or 8 years or whatever it is. And so that expiration day is coming up at the end of this year. So the Republicans are working very hard to try to permanently extend all these things that are supposed to expire on New Year's Eve 2025. And they are definitely going to fold in these tighter deduction rules as part of their larger legislative package. Now, they're going to call it, a tax cut for the middle class and all these things. But the fact is, if you look at the overall effect of this tax law, people in the first year, if it gets extended, people in the top 1% of the highest income 1%, people make over $900,000 a year, they'll get a $46,000 tax cut. People in the middle of the income range will get about less than $3 a day. And even that $3 a day can be so easily wiped out by your kid losing services at school, being kicked off Medicaid, all the things that they're planning to pay for these tax cuts for. That's going to impact people much more than the few bucks a day they might get in this tax package. So it's not a tax package for the middle class. It's not a tax package for working people. It's a tax package for very rich people and for very large corporations.
Color me shocked. The wealthy get wealthier. The working class gets poorer. Will, I appreciate the time. We got work to do. I appreciate it, though, Will. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Will Rice, Americans for Tax Fairness. Check out their website, AmericansForTaxFairness.org. Are you surprised by this? Shocked? No, of course not. This is what we've become accustomed to. And I hope Will's right. I hope everyone has awakened to the reality that our tax code is badly slanted. And maybe this is something, I don't know, come 2026, maybe we start thinking about voting on. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day a house fire claimed the life of a true champion for working people. Lucy Gonzalez Parsons was born in Texas. Most of her childhood is a mystery, but it is thought she was born into slavery and was African American, Mexican American, and Native American. After the Civil War, she met and married a Confederate soldier, Albert Parsons. The couple had to leave Texas because they were in danger due to their anti-segregationist activism. They came to Chicago, where they became involved in the city's labor movement. Albert edited The Alarm, a newspaper for working people. Lucy helped to write for the paper. Together, they supported the fight for the 8-hour workday, giving speeches throughout the city. Albert was one of the 8 men tried for the bombings at a workers' rally at Chicago's Haymarket Square in 1886. Although it was clear he was not even present when the bomb was thrown, Albert was convicted and hanged. After losing her beloved husband, Lucy kept up the fight for working people. She was a founding member of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. She continued to speak and write for the causes of women's rights and workers' rights. Because of her activism, the Chicago police called her more dangerous than 1,000 rioters. In 1915, she helped to lead a hunger march of thousands of people in Chicago. At the march, the iconic labor song Solidarity Forever was sung for the very first time.
Solidarity forever, solidarity forever, solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So look, I know tax policy is not the sexiest thing, especially when the right keeps selling us on they're the defenders of our tax dollars. And look, I want the best medications. I want the best drugs. To help people live longer lives, healthier lives, all that stuff. And the sad reality is what you've got coming out of the Trump administration is the messaging of how wonderful they are and you know how they care, while simultaneously gutting all of the funding that would go to some of this stuff. For instance, you go back to the big speech on Tuesday night, and they brought this little boy out in a police uniform who's got cancer, and they've made a big emotional big deal about it, and the kid's amazing. The kid is just an amazing kid, and the messaging that's come out of that. Well, look at the Democrats; they didn't applaud because you've used this kid as a tool in your messaging. While simultaneously, what you're doing is you're gutting the funding to find the cure for the thing that might kill him. It's not about better governance. It's about branding. It's about salesmanship. It's about getting people to be pitted against each other. I look at what we're seeing, and what's frustrating is we could have a society that's a lot more equal. We could have a society where if you work hard, play by the rules, you actually get ahead. We could have a society where every person is able to pursue an education as far as their talents will take them. We could have a system that says if you're sick, if you have cancer, if you need medical help, you get it. We could be that country. We're not, but we could be if we had a sane, rational tax code. But instead, what we have is a tax code where the winners continue to win and then want to win more. I look at what's going on with Medicaid. They keep saying, we're not cutting it. No, why would we do such a thing? While their policy is doing just that, and the right-wing messaging machine is, well, you know, there are deserving and undeserving. You know, maybe we should have block grants going to states. It's kind of like Reagan did. Reagan didn't destroy programs legislatively or write them off with executive orders. They just defunded them with block grants. And you gave the money to governors who said, well, we could use this for other things. Also, especially on the Medicaid front, and I heard this argument where all the illegals are getting Medicaid, and you go, no, they're prohibited from accessing Medicaid. But don't let the truth get in your way. My favorite was Steve Bannon, who has made the argument that Medicaid won't be cut for Trump supporters, but everybody else. So if you've got a job and you're a Trump supporter, you voted for Trump, you're going to be okay. But those undeserving poor, you know, anyone else, they don't get it. And this is masterful, because you've taken a program that was supposed to be the line in the sand, the net under our feet, and you've now qualified it by saying, well, you've got to meet certain criteria. Your citizenship isn't enough. Being an American now isn't enough. And we're going to start, I guess, in the public forum, deciding who is worthy and who isn't. And I look at the situation that we're in my household. My wife was involved in was the victim of a careless driver, near fatal motorcycle accident. She's never going to be the person she was before. She's probably never going to be the functional person she was before, which means that safety net that you want in place for all families, not just mine, isn't there. And the care and the things that she needs are only going to be available. And this is what upsets working families as well, is once we're indigent, once we're at a poverty level, or if we're deserving. And I come back to, and I think about this quite often now. Before, I thought about it on a purely compassionate, humanitarian level, with empathy and compassion for others, and the want to ensure that everyone leads at least a somewhat reasonable existence. I now look at it firsthand as someone who is looking at our future with questions and a bit of stress. Now, we're fortunate, being in the situation that we're in, but the vast majority of families aren't. And as we're gutting Medicaid, and they are, understand, the Republican House passed a budget requiring massive cuts. And you heard about it from no one in the mainstream corporate-controlled media. I know PBS's NewsHour, you know, they went and they asked the House Budget Committee chairman, this Jody Arrington, about the $880 billion in cuts that they assigned to the House Energy and Commerce Committee, and asked, well, you know, can you do any of this stuff without gutting Medicaid? And the answer is no. There's no conceivable way. But they're sticking to it. It's their story. They're sticking to it. And this is my frustration, even Trump. I don't know why anyone would ask me anymore. So for us, for you, me, you know, people who want to have a functional nation, one where an honest meritocracy is possible, we're not there. For those of us who want a country that is going to prosper and families to be able to prosper, the policies we're seeing out of this administration are not helping us. They are not good for us in any way, shape, or form. And yet, what I hear in the media sphere is, well, the same kind of rhetoric that got us into the mess that we're in now. We need to enrich the wealthy and take from the undeserving. It really is Robin Hood in reverse. And the question is will we as a society, will we put up with it? And as I said, look, the solutions will come out of the suffering. When they gut this and it actually happens, maybe that will spring us to action. We'll see. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, freespeech.org, for our video content. We got a long way to go together. but we'll get there. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Allison Keyes. With just a week to go before a government shutdown, House Republicans are throwing down the gauntlet. House Speaker Mike Johnson is setting up a vote for Tuesday on a bill to keep federal agencies funded through September 30th, and he's daring Democrats to vote against it and risk a shutdown. It's got the backing of President Trump, but Democrats are skeptical. That's demonstrators in Washington, D.C., and there's also a vigil in Philadelphia as people express solidarity with Ukraine. At least 14 died in Russian attacks overnight, a week after that contentious Oval Office meeting between President Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky. CBS's Linda Kenyon explains.
These attacks come after President Trump limited Ukraine's access to military aid and intelligence sharing. Rose Gottemiller served as Deputy Secretary General of NATO during Donald Trump's first term in office.